these kinds of occasions to say at the start of a talk like this that it's a great privilege and a pleasure to be here. And quite often when people say that, they don't really mean it. But I do mean it, because it is a real pleasure for me to be here tonight speaking with you about green politics and green philosophy. Because a few years ago, I didn't really see any very great connection between these two parts of my life, between philosophy, the ivory tower, and the public life that I was involved in. I didn't really see any very natural way to integrate my life as a practicing politician with my life as an academic, as a philosopher. But that's changed over the past few years, and it now seems to me, and I'll try to explain this in the next half an hour or so, it now seems to me that green politics and green philosophy fit like a glove, or are two sides of the same coin, that they really cannot be extricated one from another. And this has been a happy event in my life to see these things coming together, and I hope to explain to you, as I say, why I see them as being so intimately related. Now, another autobiographical remark. I got into this game as an undergraduate many years ago, over half my life ago, at Oxford, studying the famous Politics, Philosophy and Economics course. And actually quite a bit of what I'm going to be talking about this evening is economics and green economics, which in many ways I think is the glue, if you like, that binds together green philosophy and green politics. And so it's the economics that I turn first, and it's perhaps a good thing to be turning to at this time, because it's very much on our minds. It's an important matter, and may become even more important in our lives before too long. It seems that this week, this very week, the financial crisis has morphed in the minds of many people, and certainly in the minds of the media, into an economic crisis, for example, with the dreadful unemployment figures that we had yesterday. And I think that there is a severe economic crisis now in the offing. And I want to talk more about that. How did we get into that economic crisis? Well, the way it started, or at least the way it was set off, was very much to do with unsustainable habits and patterns of consumption, with the vast amount, the absolute oceans of debt that the world is now swimming in. The figure for personal household debt in the UK is at a record level of about £35,000 per capita. Many of you will be aware that the subprime mortgage lending market, with people having what turned out to be unrepayable debts on their houses, was the spark that ignited this financial crisis. Or to put it another way, that detonated it. Yeah? A nice little new word for your vocabulary tonight. The crisis was detonated by the subprime problem. This is part of a much broader phenomenon, which is unsustainable levels of debt, unsustainable levels of consumption, an unsustainable degree of materialism in our world, an accumulation of material things, of bits and bobs, and in many places crap that we don't need and doesn't make us happy, that by purchasing we have got ourselves into this bind through. And of course, you're already starting to see how there's a very strong green dimension to the financial crisis, and by extension to the economic crisis, in its beginnings, in the way that it has come to be. But not just that, because remember also that another key element of the crisis has been the dramatic rise in the prices of various essentials in our economy, most notably perhaps food, and underlying food and everything else, oil. The oil price hikes of the last few years have made it far, far more difficult for governments to start getting out of the financial crisis than it would otherwise have been. And these oil price rises are not going to go away. It's true that the price of oil has come down quite dramatically in the last few months as the speculative bubble that had built up around oil burst. And it's also true that oil prices could carry on coming down somewhat further in the near future, especially if we do go into recession, let alone depression. But oil prices are never going to return to the levels they were at 5 years ago, let alone 25 years ago. Why? Well, we all actually know the reason why. It's because oil is starting to run out. Well, to put it slightly more technically, we have probably reached or are soon going to reach the moment of peak oil production, the moment when the totality of the world's oil reserves peaks and starts to dip. This moment was reached in the United States about 40 years ago. It's probably being reached in the world as a whole right about now. And what this means is that the age of cheap, plentiful oil is coming to an end, and there is nothing that anybody can do about it. And this is going to bring untold changes in our lives, and it can bring them relatively pleasantly if we deal with it sensibly and forward plan, or it can bring them in a truly cataclysmic way if we do not. And the early stages of this peak oil crisis have been another underlying factor in the economic crisis that we are now getting into. And finally, of course, there is the biggest crisis of them all, and the most terrifying in terms of its potential threat to us as a species, which is, of course, the climate crisis. Now, you might think that the onset of peak oil and the possibility of an economic crisis could be good news in terms of providing perhaps an inadvertent route to climate salvation. So, for example, it's very interesting to notice that average traffic speeds on Britain's motorways over the past year have declined for the first time in a very long time. And the suggested explanation for this is that people are trying to economise on their petrol usage because of the enormous increase in the price of oil. But unfortunately, we can't really afford to be so sanguine or optimistic about the influences of these things upon the climate crisis unless we also act deliberately and concertedly to make sure that they carry through into something better. And here are the reasons. In terms of peak oil, there's a terrible danger that what will happen is that people will turn directly to the nearest possible alternatives to oil as cheap, plentiful oil starts to rapidly to run out. And those alternatives are pretty climate disastrous. They are, of course, things such as coal, and especially the conversion of coal into oil, which is a synthetic possibility, very, very bad in terms of carbon emissions. And even worse still, the so-called tar sands and oil shales, which there's a lovely analogy to understand what these are, which is that if you imagine you're in a pub, and instead of the beer, the pub is pumping oil out of the pumps, then the tar sands and the oil shales are a bit like what all the little tiny bits of beer which get on the floor in a pub and are kind of mixed up in all the sawdust and the dirt. And you get all of those together and you kind of crank them through a machine at the cost of an enormous expense of energy, and you get some kind of gungy oil-type stuff in very small quantities out of the other side. That's roughly what the tar sands and the oil shales are. You can get more oil out of them, but it's incredibly, incredibly inefficient process and really climate disastrous in terms of the emissions that will be given off. And in terms of the economic crisis, of course, what we're seeing all across the world is people saying, oh, at a time like this, we can't think about the environment. You know, I'm about to lose my job, or my firm's about to go down the plug hole, trash all the environmental regulations, plunder the environment, and that will get us out of the problem. Well, it might, in a way, get us out of the problem in an extremely, extremely short-termist time frame. But we really would be jumping out of the frying pan into the fire if we did that, into the fire of once again, an enhanced greenhouse effect and other associated environmental disasters, if that's the route that we choose to take. So the crisis that we're in is multi-pronged, or has multiple underlying dimensions, and we need to find a way of tackling all those dimensions together. Now, the Green Party has the germ, I believe, of the answer to this in terms of short and medium term economic and political planning. It's called the Green New Deal. The idea, this is an idea that's been put forward by our party leader, Caroline Lucas, is that we're in a situation similar in gravity, or possibly even worse than the situation that Roosevelt faced in the 1930s. We need to stabilise the financial system, we need to stabilise the economy, we need to prevent it going down into a depression. But, unlike Roosevelt, there's an additional massive constraint, which is that we can't afford to just do it by just building lots of factories, belching smoke and bridges and so on and so forth. We have to think about what's the intelligent way to invest in ourselves and in our future if we're going to do a lot of this massive pump priming type government activity to prevent the fall into a depression. So the obvious thing to do is to put this massive investment into green infrastructure, is to give ourselves a proper green transport network, is to put massive investment into energy efficiency measures, into, for example, household insulation for everybody to a very, very strong degree, into renewable energy of all generally sustainable kinds, and so on and so forth. And I think this is basically right. And this is a kind of, if you like, green Keynesianism in economics. But I think we have to go even further and even deeper than that, because I think the crisis that we're in, it's not just an economic crisis, it's not just a financial crisis, it's not even just, as I've explained, a crisis in what I like to call the real world, in the ecosystems. It's not just a depletion crisis or a pollution crisis, depletion of oil, for example, pollution in terms of carbon emissions, although crucially it is those. What it also is a crisis for the neoliberal politics and the neoclassical economics, which is overwhelmingly, arguably, responsible for getting us into this mess. So the interesting question for someone who actually wants to think about economics at this time, it seems to me, and it's also a philosophical question, is there a revolution going on or about to occur in economics as a discipline? With economics being thrown itself into a state of some disarray by these developments, is there an opportunity here, or is it perhaps already happening, that we're getting a move towards a greener economics in terms of economics as a discipline? And I think the answer might be yes. And here is where your handout comes in. So can I invite you all to turn to your handout? Those of you who don't have a handout, perhaps you could shift closer to somebody who does. And turn over to the second page. So this page here. So what I've done here is I've just photocopied a few diagrams from the work of someone who I believe to be a great man. Now, his name is at the top here. It's Herman Daly. And he is one of the founders of the incipient discipline that likes to call itself ecological economics, or sometimes simply green economics. And he's been arguing for some time that the way that economics thinks of the world and the way that economics thinks of the economy is disastrous. It's a recipe for disaster. And I think what he's been saying is being massively vindicated by the events of the last 18 months or so. So I want to explain to you a little bit more about what green or ecological economics amounts to and how there might be a revolution happening as we speak, as it were, in the discipline of economics. So look at these two diagrams. So you've got one diagram here of standard economics, and below a different diagram. So focusing on the standard economics diagram first, you start in the middle and you work your way out. Cycles of production and consumption, the production allegedly to supply the wants, the desires of the consumer. Although, of course, as we all know, many of those wants or desires are in fact manufactured by advertising. And this cycle doesn't know any end. It doesn't have any limits. It could go on forever. It spirals outwards. It carries on growing forever. And that's the way the traditional economics has thought of its subject. It's thought of its subject in the sense of human beings as so-called homo economicus, as a being that has potentially infinite desires, wants, that can never be fully satiated and can always use to consume more. And it's thought of its subject in a sense of discipline as being something which is the way of understanding this potentially infinite system, which has no limits to the growth that it claims to explain and in fact encourages. And what Davy suggests is that there is possibly available to us a whole different way of seeing the economic system, a whole different way of seeing and of thinking about the world. And the first indication of it is in this diagram immediately below. Steady-state economics. We have something that contains the cycle of production and consumption, namely the ecosystem, from which so-called raw materials are taken. I say so-called raw materials, I'll come back to why I say that later, and into which waste returns. But we mustn't overly deplete these raw materials that we are dependent on, for example, oil. And we mustn't, as it were, excrete so much waste that it overwhelms our life support system, as in, for example, carbon emissions. And before that, although a note of hope here, of course, is that we did control this, the overproduction of ozone, which threatened to severely undermine our life support system 20-odd years ago, but which managed to control, more difficult to control, carbon emissions. So this way of thinking about economics is a whole different way of, as it were, seeing what your subject is. Turn now to the next diagram, figure 2. This is going back again to the standard economics picture. Slightly different way of looking at it. Again, it's this kind of circular flow, which in the earlier diagram Davy showed growing out and out and out and spiralling outwards in potentially infinite growth. Here we see goods and services being supplied from firms to households and factors of production going into what firms produce. And turn now finally to the figures on the back there, figure 3. And this is really Davy's preferred model. This is the way he wants us to think about the world and the economy. And I think it's an extremely, extremely useful way and worthy of some real attention. He suggests, as it were, that these diagrams of standard economics are kind of fine for a world which is relatively empty, in the sense of relatively empty of human activity, in which we don't have to worry about banging up against the limits to growth, right? That in that kind of world, you can sort of bracket out the ecosystem. It doesn't have to bother you that much. But the world that we're actually getting into, or arguably are already in, is much more like the second diagram here, the full world diagram. And I think one quite useful way of translating, if you like, the idea of green economics, green politics, and green philosophy is philosophy, politics, and economics for a full world. It's full world thinking that we need now. The first time it became clear to us that the limits to growth were being hit on a worldwide basis was with the ozone hole crisis. It's now becoming extremely clear that there are multiple potential limits that we're hitting, most notably the ones that I've already described, namely oil depletion and excess greenhouse gas emissions. If your world is something like the full world, there's very little space in the ecosystem to absorb the waste you produce, and very little, as it were, scope available for getting hold of extra raw materials, so-called, with which to produce the so-called goods that we apparently need, or at least want. So, Daly's green ecological economics, economics for a full world, suggests that there's a terrible risk in the standard manner of thinking in economics and in politics of ignoring these limits. They're simply bracketed out. That we've run headlong into this risk, and that this imperils us, let alone, of course, the vast numbers of other creatures that we share this world with. Obviously, the world never really was empty, right? It was just full of lots of other life that wasn't part of a series of economic calculations that we entered into. In the full world, there's very little space left for anything that that isn't of monetizable value to human beings. Okay. So Daly is very happy to allow that standard economics, mainstream economics, with its traditional diagrams, etc., is very good at the job of allocation of scarce resources. Of saying, right, if we've got a given distribution of wealth and we want to know how optimally or most efficiently to allocate it between two people so that they each end up maximally satisfied. Economics is very good at sorting out that kind of problem. But it doesn't have much to say about problems of distribution. Well, what about if that initial distribution of wealth is unequal? This is a political problem which traditional economics is in practice largely silent on, let alone if you think about the distribution not just being across space, but also across time. If you think about distributive justice as something which includes future generations as well, economics is incredibly silent about that. But then again, so is politics, right? Future generations don't have any dollars, but they don't have any votes either. Right? It leaves an enormous responsibility on our shoulder. This is a responsibility which we absolutely have to rise to at this point in history, or we will be committing an absolutely monumental crime. Traditional economics tends to discount the interests of future generations. There's actually this practice in economics called discounting. Another way of expressing the practice of discounting is through the payments of interest, right? Which basically says money now is always going to be worth more than money later. So if somebody in the future has the same amount of money as I have now, it won't be worth as much money as I have now. The enormous challenge which I'm talking about, which we have to rise to, which I think is absolutely integral to the meaning, the real meaning of being green, is being fair and being caring towards future generations, because they depend, in a certain sense, entirely on us. And when we live beyond our means, we develop a debt towards them, which will be unrepayable. Where Bailey's ideas really come to full fruition is in the concept of scale, which he thinks is entirely ignored by traditional economics. And you can get a sense of the concept of scale and its importance to ecological or green economics by comparing these two diagrams. Right? Traditional economics doesn't really have anything much to say about whether the economy this size or the economy this size is any better or any more suitable. It does everything only at the margins. And it's the problem of scale which really most centrally, I think, suggests that there might be an ecological economics revolution happening now, if we're actually, as some economists are, starting to think seriously, even as to some extent Mr. Stern did in his report, starting to think seriously about the scale of the economy and thinking about that scale in comparison to the scale of something else which it is nested within, namely the ecosystem. So it's a kind of transformation of vision which Daly and the green economists want us to undertake. There's an interesting parallel to it in the history of thought, which is the so-called Copernican Revolution, which took the Earth from being at the centre of the universe and placed the Sun instead at the centre of the universe. And of course, as time went by later, the Earth was further displaced to the periphery as we came to discover or understand that in fact the Sun is merely the centre of a solar system in a galaxy, and there are many galaxies, and so on and so forth. Nietzsche says somewhere that this is a kind of diminution of the centrality of human beings, which is a blow to our ego, which is going to take a long time for us to recover from. I think he may be somewhat right. This leads some people to say, and it's an intriguing idea, that if there is an ecological economics revolution happening, it's kind of like the Copernican Revolution in reverse, because the Earth is being moved back to the centre of things again. Yeah, the Earth is being moved back to the centre of things again, as in those diagrams that Daly likes. I think this is an intriguing idea, but I don't think it's really accurate. It seems to me what one has to get clear about is whether or not it's the Earth that is being talked about at the centre, or human beings that are being talked about as being at the centre. What do I mean by that? Well, in the case of the Copernican Revolution, it was human beings on the Earth that were at the centre. And then the earth became displaced. But did the human beings become displaced from being notionally at the centre of things? Arguably, there's a vast tradition in thought and in philosophy which has kept human beings very much at the centre of things, or perhaps even arguably more at the centre of things than they were at the time of Copernicus, as God just started to move towards the margins. Right? And human wants or human desires have started to become idolised. Right? Obviously, what I'm referring to here is something like standard economics and Homo economicus. One can trace it back, though, through the history of philosophical thought, arguably. For example, the thought of somebody like Immanuel Kant, who talked about a Copernican revolution in philosophy, which put the human self at the centre of philosophy. But there's a kind of alternative tradition, it seems to me, which goes with mainstream science. It goes through Kepler and Newton and through Darwin, because, of course, what Darwin did, he said, look, it's not even that human beings are at the centre or the apogee of being on this rock, right? Yeah, we're on this peripheral rock, but we're not even the most important things on this rock. We're just one being that happens to have taken a certain ecological niche on this rock, and there's all these other beings also that have very cleverly got their own ecological niches as well. And moreover, we're interdependent with each other. And that's, of course, where the science of ecology has developed out of the science of evolution. We're absolutely interdependent upon each other. We're nothing, for example, without the soil. Probably we're actually nothing without bees, as Einstein famously said. Without bees, we'd probably have about 5 years. Which is quite worrying given that bee numbers are in decline. So what I'm suggesting is that thinking about the development of human thought over the last several centuries in this way actually perhaps adds strength to the idea that if there is an ecological economics revolution happening in economics, it is firmly in the line of the great scientific revolutions of the past few centuries. And what's actually potentially a relatively marginal problematic development, although it has been absolutely central politically to the actual development of our societies, is the emphatic and idolatry focus upon human beings and human desires as central. And then you can start to see ecological economics as building on biology and ecology, and standard economics as a problematic and relatively unscientific development that has been, if you like, brought in to justify our desire to satisfy our own desires with disastrous consequences. So taking our finitude and our planet's finitude fully seriously, as somebody like Herman Davy does, brings us to the idea that everything that we do must be sustainable, that everything that we draw upon must ultimately be renewable. If we are not to also draw a line in the future, which is the end of human civilization, the end of the human race, and many other creatures besides. Okay, so there's quite a bit on green economics, which I believe represents a genuine qualitative advance in our understanding of ourselves and of our world, and in that sense is in the best tradition of the early stages of great scientific revolutions. You might still be asking, okay, but so that's green economics in outline, but what is green philosophy or green ideology? Well, perhaps one way into that is by thinking about how it relates to ideologies that we're perhaps more familiar with. So, what about socialism, for example? Is green philosophy and green economics compatible with socialism? Well, there's some serious problems with socialism in this regard. There's a very intriguing book called Eco-Socialism or Eco-Capitalism, which argues the case that the hidden reason, the little understood reason, key reason why the Soviet Union collapsed was because it was faced with a devastating and growing series of ecological crises, environmental crises, even worse than those which the Western world has generated. Of course, one of them is very famous, Chernobyl,
But this author argues that there are a whole load of others as well, which fatally undermined the Soviet economy more so than did, for example, the Cold War. Interesting case. A bit closer to home, some of you will remember when Tony Blair left office that a couple of Labour MPs tried to challenge him to become his successor as Prime Minister and tried to stop Gordon Brown from being crowned as Prime Minister. They didn't succeed. One of them was John McConnell, and he stood as a socialist, which is a novel thing these days in the Labour Party. And what's very interesting about McConnell's platform, if you read his campaign documentation, was that he basically didn't mention the environment or ecology anywhere. It was all about more jobs for the workers, more factories, and so on and so forth, and taking and more equal distribution of pay, and so on and so forth. Socialism has typically been extremely blind to the vital issue of justice across generations, justice across time as well as space, a just distribution in that sense, and completely blind to the question of scale, and has tended to be fundamentally growthist in much the same way as capitalist economics has been, suggesting that there aren't any limits to growth. We don't have to worry about that. And similarly with capitalism, whether we're talking about liberalism or conservatism or what have you, there's tended to be a relentless materialism and growthism. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why people are so terrified of the economic crisis that we're about to go into and of the financial crisis that we're already in. Because capitalist economics only actually functions properly if the economy is expanding. It can only either expand or contract. This is to do with the nature of money and the continued drive to accumulate capital in a capitalist economic system. It's not at all clear that there can be any genuinely capitalist economics that is a steady-state economics of the kind that Daly recommends, that is compatible with taking seriously the limits to growth. So, what I want to suggest is that the green ideology or the green philosophy does exist, but it is distinct from any political philosophy that we're familiar with. The best name for it, I think, it's not original to me, is ecologism. This is a term due to Andy Dobson and his excellent book, Green Political Thought. And what ecologism says, radically unlike capitalism and socialism, is that we must not continue to plunder our environment in the cause of growth. But what we have to take as being the central phenomenon is the Earth as a viable ecological system. And we have to see ourselves as, if you like, secondary to that, or ancillary to that. And we have to take seriously that without this viable ecosystem, we are nothing. We are merely dust. We have to put the Earth centrally, right, to go back to this metaphor from the discussion of a Copernican revolution in economics. And of course, we have to take seriously, therefore, if we're really going to put the Earth centrally, we have to take seriously a place in it for all the other creatures as well. For viable, sustainable soil, for example, over time. Just take one really, really crucial example. But of course, there are many, many others. And this is why before, by the way, I said that I thought that there was something dubious about the term natural resources or raw materials. Because these terms implicitly suggest that basically the Earth has been constructed for us to use and for us to plunder. And if one makes the ecologistic vision shift and instead sees the Earth as a set of living systems, as the fundamental phenomenon, then it immediately seems dubious to think of certain parts of that Earth as raw materials, as though they're waiting to be cooked by us. Right. Now, I think that in the short to medium term, ecologism is perfectly compatible with certain aspects of business as we know it. Greens are typically all in favour of small businesses, of local businesses, of increased competitive rules to against the monopolies or oligopolies that are very significant in our contemporary capitalist system. In the long run, it does seem to me as though something with some similarities to socialism, but it would have to be an ecological socialism, must result from a serious shift to this ecologistic ideology or philosophy. I like to use the term eco-societyism. It's not very pretty, but it does explain the idea quite clearly. The idea of societyism is we have to think of ourselves as one, as truly all in this together. And I think people are starting to think, I hope that people are starting to think of themselves as truly all in this together, because if we don't, then we really are stuffed. Societyism, of the society as being the fundamental phenomenon in a full world, right? In a world where there really are very, very significant zero-sum game type constraints, where if one person has more of something, it means that somebody else has to have less of that thing, because there is a limit to the total amount of the thing. And an eco-societyism, obviously, because it's not enough to just think of ourselves first and foremost, fundamentally, as a society. We have to think about society as absolutely and completely nested in the ecosystem of which it is a part. So again, to relate back to contemporary alternative political philosophies, the dominant political philosophy of our time in the academic world and in the actual world is called by academic political philosophers liberalism. It's most prominently represented by the philosophy of John Rawls, and it involves the following justification for certain levels of inequality in our society. It says that if some people have more than others, this can be to the benefit of everybody if the extra wealth that some people have trickles down to the others or somehow comes to them through increased efficiency of the economy or what have you. But this is essentially a way of thinking that is appropriate for an empty world. This is essentially a way of thinking that is only appropriate when we do not take into account being at the limits to growth. Because when you're at the limits to growth, you are in a fundamentally zero-sum game situation. And this is why I think that something like eco-societyism has to be the long-term consequence of ecologism, which is going to enable us to survive as a civilization. And it would have to involve something pretty close to complete equality across time as well as across space. In other words, basically, once you are at the limits to growth, then for any given population, there is a maximum possible per capita ecological footprint which is compatible with that level of population being sustainable. Now, if one person exceeds that ecological footprint, somebody else has to have less than it. And it seems to me that once the fundamental justification for some people having more, namely that supposedly so that everybody can have more, right, is put into question by it not being possible for everybody to have more, because as it's sometimes put by an ecological economist who I like very much, the cake can't keep getting bigger because the ingredients are running out. Right? Once you start to take really seriously the limits to growth, it's no longer possible to argue that. See, it seems to me that the justification that people who like to think of themselves as fair-minded and wanting the best for everybody, the justification that those people tacitly have for inequality is something like, well, if it's possible for something to be better off for everybody, then it's okay for some to have more than others. But when you're in a situation which actually takes seriously the limits to growth, it just isn't possible for everybody to have more. So I suggest that something very close to a full egalitarianism over time and over space does have to be the long-term consequence of ecologism. And this is quite a radical result in political philosophy. So, to conclude, I believe that the owl of Minerva has flown for growthism, for socialism, for capitalism, for liberalism, for materialism, for all the ideologies that we're used to. And I think that this is our time. This is the
time for a unified vision of green politics, green philosophy, green economics, which obviously I've been trying to outline.
I don't think we have any choice about adopting this vision or not. If we do not adopt it, we will end up in barbarism and perhaps total civilizational collapse.
I have a nightmare. You can read about my nightmare in Margaret Atwood's new book or in Cormac McCarthy's chilling and horrifying, amazing book, The Road, about a sort of post-total kind of crisis-type world. But I also have a dream. I have a dream of a relatively high-tech and low-tech future, a much more localized future, a much more equal future, a future where our society keeps getting better, but not because there's a larger amount of baubles and stuff and things that we own, but because we have more great novels and more ways of actually fulfilling ourselves and of understanding ourselves and each other and our world. And I believe, or at least I hope, that the dream is stronger than the nightmare, because the alternative really doesn't bear thinking about, as those of you who have read The Road will understand what I mean. And you can help make my dream come true. A famous philosopher who was also a great political economist once said that philosophers have only interpreted the world. Well, with your help, I intend to change it. Thank you.